I now continue with topic number 2. As I've mentioned before, one very important reason for the delay so far in Russia's attack is that Russia's rulers want to choose their moment for war based on optimum conditions. They want their defeat of the West to be as decisive as possible, yet be as inexpensive as possible to Russia in casualties and other terms. This is far more important to Russia's rulers of today than any preconceived timetable. But Russia's military supremacy over the West has now become so lopsided that it's no longer the most critical guide to their thinking. As I will explain shortly, the Kremlin has already succeeded this month in secretly crippling one ingredient in America's feverish first-strike plan, which I revealed in detail last month. Increasingly, the Kremlin is preoccupied with ensuring that Russia's domination of the earth after the war will be as trouble-free as possible. The inner circle in the Kremlin today never lose sight of their true enemy. That enemy is the worldwide network of Bolsheviks, whose main power base today is the United States. In the coming war, Russia wants to concentrate on that enemy, while preserving the rest of the world as much as possible for post-war domination. So they're doing all they can to neutralize as much of the world as possible before the war itself. Uncommitted nations are being urged to join the Soviet orbit as allies and friends, or failing that, to at least stay neutral. Westward-leaning nations are being wooed by Russia and by Russian client states, with the line that America is a paper tiger and neutrality between East and West would be enough to satisfy Moscow. And even American allies, such as West Germany, are being lured away from staunch support of America through both carrot and stick methods. And this way, the Russians hope to leave themselves with a minimum of hostilities and resentment to disrupt their domination of the earth after nuclear war won. And unlike their Bolshevik enemies, Russia's rulers of today do not intend to dominate the world by means of a one-world government. To the Russian spiritual communists, the one-world government concept is as diseased as Bolshevism itself. Instead, the Russians intend to dominate the earth in a different manner. It will be an extension of the present satellite system in critical areas, such as those bordering the Soviet Union. Other areas judged to be of less importance to Russia will be left to go their own way with relatively independent governments. Every nation on earth, however, will be required to make its peace with Russia as the preeminent power on earth. In matters of trade, for example, Russia will have to be put at the top of the priority list by everyone. And to guard against any attempt by any nation or satellite country to upset Russia's power, the anti-war machine network will stand guard worldwide without ceasing. These machines, the Russian hovering cosmospheres, armed with charged particle beam weapons, will make short work of any attempted rebellion against Russia's supremacy. This, then, is the Russian plan for post-war domination of the entire earth. If the Kremlin gets its way, the long-standing commitment for a monolithic, all-powerful, one-world government is headed for total annihilation like Bolshevism itself. The quiet rebirth of private enterprise now taking place in Russia and Eastern Europe is a harbinger of things to come on the international scene as well. In politics and economics and even in religion, no nation and no individual will dare completely ignore the Kremlin. But neither will there be complete centralized control like that sought by the Rockefeller cartel and their Bolsheviks. The Russian blueprint for world domination is awesome, but of course it will come to nothing unless Russia is able to achieve a decisive victory in nuclear war I. And as I revealed last month, our own unseen rulers are setting in motion a suicidal nuclear first strike plan against Russia. At the anticipated cost of several hundred million lives, the combined Rockefeller-Bolshevik forces who control America today are trying to achieve a stalemate with Russia in nuclear war I. To accomplish this, an American first strike is to cripple Russia's space triad of strategic weapons, that is, the beam weapons base on the moon, the orbiting Cosmos interceptor killer satellites, and the floating cosmospheres. The United States lacks the capability to attack these weapon systems directly. But last month I detailed the American strategy to cripple them by destroying their bases in Russia. Russia, having learned the American plan some 3 months ago through the efforts of their own KGB, are working fast to thwart the American first strike plan. And earlier this month, a critical development took place that is destined to cripple the American first strike plan. Of the three countries whose real estate is critical to the American plan, namely Norway, Iran, and China, one has now been effectively neutralized, and it is the most important of the three. Last month in AUDIO LETTER 37, I explained the necessity for American access to China's Xinjiang province as part of the first strike plan against the Russian space triad. Without that access, the United States will be unable to mount an effective attack against Russia's cosmosphere installations at Semipalatinsk and Novosibirsk. That alone will be sufficient to doom the United States in the coming war. For this reason, among others, the matter of China has for some time been the number one item on the Kremlin pre-war agenda. Last month, Chairman Hua of China visited Romania and Yugoslavia in connection with Russian overtures for a reconciliation with China. Now, I must report to you that these meetings have already borne fruit. When Hua met with Romania's Premier Ceausescu, he was offered certain positive inducements on behalf of the Soviet Union. However, he was also informed that Russia is determined to move fast in its preparations for war against the West. Hua was told if China is to restore ties with Russia on a favorable basis, it must be done quickly. Hua was also told that the Soviet Union would much prefer to offer China the opportunity to restore good relations without loss of face, rather than to have to force the issue militarily in the near future. Accordingly, Hua was informed of some of the current Russian capabilities in advanced warfare techniques. And to allow Hua to assess the situation in a pragmatic way, he was informed that the Soviet Union would shortly provide him with a series of three demonstrations of Russia's operational geophysical warfare arsenal. The first demonstration was to be an undersea earthquake in the vicinity of Taiwan, scheduled for September 2, 1978. The second, to take place the following day, was to be an earthquake on land in an area of Western Europe that is not generally known for earthquake activity. Both of these, Hua was told, would have intensities in a Richter scale range of 6.5 approximately. As I revealed long ago, this is the nominal yield for which most of the Russian earthquake-producing cobalt bombs are designed. The third demonstration, the finale, was to be an earthquake centered on the Caspian Sea, coast of Iran, north of Tehran. Hua was told that the Iran quake would occur on or about September 14. However, the exact strength of the quake was not predicted, other than to say that it would be strong, quote-unquote. The reason given was that the Iran quake would be brought about by remote means, whose results are not yet so highly predictable. The point which was then driven home for Hua was that the same remote means used on Iran would be used on China's Xinjiang province, should American personnel be allowed into that area. On Saturday, September 2nd, an undersea earthquake measuring 6.6 on the Richter scale occurred near Taiwan, right on schedule. In Taipei, tall buildings swayed. Concrete utility poles waved around like ship's masts on a heavy sea. Blackouts took place briefly, and traffic was snarled. But then everything calmed down again with only a few minor injuries. The next morning, southern Germany was rocked by the most powerful earthquake in 35 years, measuring about 6 on the Richter scale. 11 days later, on September 14, the grand finale began, and it was intended for a double purpose. For one thing, it was to round out the demonstration series of geophysical warfare in a spectacular manner to properly impress Chairman Hua. But in addition, it was also an attack on the second most important country in the American First Strike Plan, Iran. Last month, I explained Iran's intended role in this secret American war plan. Iran's northern border, which lies along the southern coast of the Caspian Sea, is to be used by American submersible aircraft, or subcraft, to attack three of Russia's four cosmodromes. For this reason, Russian agents are trying to bring about a revolt in Iran to overthrow the Shah. And on the morning of September 14, Russia made use of geophysical warfare in an attempt to ruin Iran's Caspian Sea coast naval facilities. Had they been successful, any American subcraft attack would have been seriously delayed while the damage was being repaired. The technique employed against Iran that day is called a seismic cannon, quote-unquote, by Russian geophysical warfare specialists. A seismic cannon consists of a long series of cobalt bombs buried deep underground at intervals along a straight line. The bombs are not detonated all at once. Instead, they are fired one after another like a string of gigantic firecrackers. When this is done at the proper rate, the seismic shock generated by the first bomb is reinforced by the explosion of the second bomb as the wave passes and so on. In this way, artificial ground shocks can be made to travel much more strongly in one direction than in any other. Therefore, they can be aimed to affect a far distant target, hence the name seismic cannon. The seismic cannon fired by Russia on the morning of September 14 was deployed far to the southwest of the Semipalatinsk nuclear test range. A string of cobalt bombs were buried in a line roughly 70 miles long in a sparsely inhabited area of the Kazakh SSR of the Soviet Union. The line was centered at approximately 45 degrees north, 70 degrees east, which is about 200 miles southwest of Lake Balkhash, and it was oriented along a line running from northeast to southwest, so that the seismic cannon was aimed at Iran's Caspian Sea coast north of Tehran. The north and east borders of Iran, including that part along the Caspian Sea coast, lie along what is called a tectonic plate boundary, or major fault line. The Russians were expecting that when the shots from their seismic cannon struck this huge fault line broadside, it would loosen the fault in the Caspian Sea area. The result shortly thereafter would be a major earthquake. They were right about that, but their seismic cannon missed the intended target. It happened because the seismic waves, while they travel most strongly in the desired direction, also spread with lesser force in other directions. The firing of the seismic cannon on September 14 was reported by Sweden's Uppsala Seismological Institute. They estimated the Richter scale reading as 6.9 and declared it to be the most powerful blast ever in that area, which was presumed to be in western Siberia. But as reported by Radio Australia, it was a very mysterious blast, and the epicenter could not be determined with certainty. The next day, the ground began shaking in northeastern Iran. The area around Tehran and the Caspian Sea felt some brief shocks, but they were not hit hard as planned. Instead, a fantastic earthquake reaching 7.7 on the Richter scale erupted some 400 miles southeast of Tehran. In moments, the town of Tabas ceased to exist, and the devastation was heavy over a wide area. Within a few days, the death count had reached 26,000 and was still climbing. Condolences to Iran soon began pouring in, and the first condolences to reach Iran were sent by Leonid Brezhnev No. 2. The seismic cannon missed its intended Caspian Sea coast target, but the performance was more than adequate for Chairman Hua. 4 days after the Iran earthquake disaster, secret meetings began in Peking between top Chinese officials and a high-level Russian delegation. An agreement in principle was reached on September 19 between Russia and China, and while verbal camouflage is hiding the fact, a secret alliance between Russia and China is now being forged. As a result of the 51 cosmospheres which were over China as recently as last month, only 6 remain, and none of these are now over the Sino-Russian border region. The three giants of the great new Asian axis, Russia, China, and Japan, are growing closer by the day, contrary to outward appearances. While all eyes are focused on manipulated events in the Middle East, truly momentous developments are taking place almost unnoticed in Asia. Russia fully intends to be the first among equals in all of this, but she also plans to make it all worthwhile for her partners in dominating the earth. Russia does not feel the need to strive for the last ounce of absolute control over our world, for Russia is looking outward toward other worlds to conquer. Topic number 3. One day in 1962, scientists at a prestigious technical university in the eastern United States attended a seminar given by a visiting Russian scientist. The topic under discussion by the Russian was a difficult problem that was of great interest to scientists in the aerospace field at the time. As the American scientists watched and listened, the Russian went through a tour de force of high-powered mathematics. Finally, he ended up with what mathematicians call a closed-form solution, quote-unquote, much to everyone's surprise. One of the American professors looked as if someone had kicked him in the stomach as he left after the seminar, and a student asked why. The professor growled, quote, "There went my research project for the next year. I was going to do it by computer, but this blankety-blank Russian just wrote down the whole solution in one line," unquote. Many times in recent years, Russian science has handed shocks to the West. For one thing, the Russians are stiff competitors in the areas of science, where we too are strong. But in addition, they are devoting tremendous amounts of effort to areas of science which are virtually ignored in the West. And they have learned some astonishing things which are not even hinted at by Western science. Russian science is perhaps most spectacular in the field of space. Right now, it's space weaponry that is in the forefront of Russian technical progress, such as the hovering cosmospheres and the charged particle beam weapon. Both of these are exclusively the property of the Soviet Union. But looking beyond the immediate needs of their holy war against Bolshevism, the rulers of Russia today are attracted to space by long-term non-military motives. For one thing, they believe that the conquest of space will give mankind all the challenge, all the danger, and all the drama we will ever need without ever again resorting to war among ourselves. But, my friends, Russia's determination to launch mankind into space really springs from just one more basic conviction. Based upon extensive scientific study, Russia's rulers are convinced beyond any doubt that we who inhabit the Earth are not alone in the universe. They have what they consider to be strong evidence that our galaxy, the Milky Way, harbors not just one but several civilizations more advanced than our own. And they are convinced that we of planet Earth are at the crossroads now. Either mankind will begin to move upward and outward from cradle Earth into space, or very soon we will destroy ourselves. If the Russians have their way, mankind will venture into space as the newest member of our galactic community. This viewpoint of Russia's ruling circles has gradually crystallized only during the past decade or so. But the studies which were destined to lead to this conclusion resulted from an awesome event which took place in Siberia 70 years ago. On June 30, 1908, a huge object streaked across the skies in that part of the world, plummeting toward the Earth. In the heavily forested remote Tunguska area of Siberia, it disappeared in a fantastic explosion. And for days afterward, strange glowing clouds and nighttime brightness in the sky were seen as far away as London, England. The Tunguska region of Siberia is so remote and inaccessible that it was not until 1927 that a Russian expedition succeeded in reaching the explosion site. But since that time, the Russians, and only the Russians, have studied the area exhaustively. They have employed every scientific tool that could possibly be of use, because the Tunguska blast area is very strange indeed. And they have reached a definite conclusion that the object that shook Siberia 7 decades ago was not a meteor, nor was it any other natural phenomenon. More than a decade ago, Russian aerospace experts, some of them famous even in the West, reached a startling conclusion. Their discovery resulted from analyzing widespread eyewitness accounts and other evidence. The Tunguska space object of 1908 had slowed down and carried out a major change of course. This final maneuver took it over the totally uninhabited area, where it exploded at an altitude of several miles. The explosion itself has been estimated as being equivalent to a huge 30-megaton hydrogen bomb, and even today, 70 years later, the entire area remains slightly radioactive. To the Russians, there is only one logical explanation that fits the mountain of facts they have compiled about the Tunguska explosion. It was a disabled spacecraft which tried unsuccessfully to make an emergency landing, exploding in mid-air in the process. The story of the Great Siberian Explosion is fascinating and is well told in a current book. The title is The Fire Came by John Baxter and Thomas Atkins, published by Warner Books, New York. But the rulers of Russia also have additional reasons for believing mankind is not alone in the cosmos. The Russians have carefully studied UFO reports from around the world. They have restricted their attention very rigidly to those which are solidly documented and backed up by evidence such as radar. But because of their Tunguska studies, they have also analyzed UFO data with open minds, and they are convinced that we are being quietly observed not by one alien civilization, but by several. As of now, the Russians have not established where these presumed galactic neighbors are coming from, but they are working on it. Powerful radio telescopes and other techniques are in use by the Soviet Union. They are trying to pick up any clues to the possible identity of our visitors. As for the vast distances involved between these unidentified neighbors and our own solar system, the Russians are unperturbed. In the course of studying scientific areas that are shunned by the West, they have discovered what they believe to be clues to the secret of interstellar travel. If these clues are correct, they believe that mankind could well be at work on our first starship within a mere generation from now. These are the motivations that are driving the Russians into space. But first, they reason that we must learn to establish ourselves and live in self-supporting ways under conditions radically different from those on Earth. And they have settled upon Venus as the first target beyond the Moon for experimental colonization. During the past year, several space probes have been launched at Venus by both Russia and the United States. But only Russia has ever landed probes on Venus, accomplishing this feat some 3 years ago with two landers. Here now, for the very first time, I can reveal what the Russians have found on Venus. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, boron, carbon, oxygen, neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon, potassium, calcium, scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc, gallium, germanium, arsenic, selenium, bromine, krypton, rubidium, strontium, yttrium, technetium, ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, silver, tellurium, iodine, xenon, tungsten, platinum in large quantities, gold also in large quantities, mercury, polonium in modest quantities, astatine, radon, and uranium in modest amounts. The other elements are either non-existent on Venus or present only in trace amounts. Overall, the Russians have concluded that it is technically feasible to sustain life permanently on Venus. So Venus is to become the first planet to be colonized by man. According to Russia's plan, Venus will be man's first tiny step to the stars. But of course, planet Earth, the cradle of mankind, will remain the only home the vast majority of men will know or want to know far into the future. What will be happening to our own precious world while the saga of space exploration is underway? My friends, the answer to that question lies not in outer space, but in inner space within ourselves. We live today in a world that grows sicker by the day, merely to satisfy the greed of powerful men. Our natural environment is sick, poisoned by pollution. Our morals and values are sick, and this sickness is promoted deliberately as a tool of power by the forces of Bolshevism. And we are physically sick with an ever-growing list of dread diseases. Western medicine has become the handmaiden of Western corporate socialist enterprise, and the more we poison ourselves, the more we are told we must spend on medicine to cure ourselves. But medically as otherwise, it is a losing battle. The more we spend, the further behind we end up. The Russian rulers are deadly serious in their conviction that all of this has to be stopped, and soon, or mankind as a whole is doomed. The condition of the entire world today is a legacy of Western civilization, as warped and controlled by our unseen rulers. We in the West have proven that we are not going to act in time to stop our slide into total self-destruction and destruction of the world in the process. So very soon, Russia's holy war against Bolshevism will rain calamity upon our heads. If the Russian holy war succeeds, the survivors worldwide will live in an era very different from that of today. It will not be utopia, but it will be an era of challenge, of spiritual rebirth, and of hope. The new Russian pattern of private enterprise will spread worldwide, including individualized agriculture. Russia herself, the breadbasket of the world a century ago, will become so once again. My friends, many surprises lie ahead, for the Russians as well as for you and me. But the time has come to face facts as we try to plan for the future. America always wins on television and in the movies, but we are living through history, not fiction. And the fact is that the world of the future will be very different from that of today, because the history of the United States as we know it is in its final pages. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.